Sky News Centre at 6. The High Court banned 5 teenage girls from London from travelling abroad after they showed an interest in going to Syria. The 15 and 16-year-olds who haven't been named can't now leave England and Wales and have had to surrender their passports. More than 130 people are now thought to have died in a series of suicide bombings in Yemen. They happened at two mosques in the capital. Four senior Sun journalists have been cleared of making payments to public officials for stories. They've been on trial at the Old Bailey, accused of securing almost a decade of information about the army. Executive editor of the Sun, Fergus Shanahan, says he's relieved they've been acquitted.
These proceedings have been the most terrible ordeal for all the families involved. Perhaps you could say as journalists we have a thick skin and we can look after ourselves, but by talking about families we've been under the most appalling strain.
Meanwhile, we're now allowed to report that an MOD official, Bettina Jordan Barber, was jailed for a year in January after earning £100,000 from leaking stories to The Sun. A 19-year-old man's beginning a 22-year prison sentence for plotting a Lee Rigby-style killing of a British soldier. Rustam Ziarmani's trial heard he'd been inspired by what happened to the Fusilier. Two of UKIP's candidates for the general election have been suspended by the party. Nigel Farage has admitted that fraud allegations against MEP Janice Atkinson couldn't look worse. Police are examining an expenses claim. Meanwhile, Stephen Howard, who was due to be stand in Scunthorpe, is being investigated over an alleged incident at his workplace. David Cameron's been quick to comment.
This does look, from what I've seen, to be very serious. And it's just the latest in a whole set of catastrophic blunders, disasters, missteps by this party.
It'll be another 11 years until we get another solar eclipse on the scale of the one we saw today in the UK. Millions of us across the country glimpsed the moon obscuring the sun this morning. That's the latest. I'm Tim Jones.
BCFM. BCFM. BCFM.
I must say, in all fairness to Crowley, he never attempted in any way to induce me to join a coven or do anything I wouldn't want to do.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Yes, the BBC in court next week for aiding and abetting terrorism. They're in the blue corner, but Matt Campbell will be in the red corner, whose brother died in the 9/11 attacks. So have the BBC to this very day been providing cover for the real 9/11 terrorists? And if so, could heads roll at the corporation? Also, the last protesters have been torn out of trees at Stapleton allotments and small holdings to make way for the Metro bus. At last, Bristol's going to get an up-to-date transport system worthy of the 21st century, or is it? We asked Bruce Williamson from Rail Futures. Plus, delayed from previous weeks, it's the band vicar of Virginia Water. He can't talk about the Middle East in his Anglican church services, but he can talk here, because it was pre-recorded, before the Bishop of Guildford's ban. We hear the Reverend Stephen Sizer break down the modern medieval-style heresy so popular in the US, that is, Christian Zionism and also Israeli Zionism. Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. But we start this week with Matt Campbell, whose brother died in the 9/11 attacks and is involved in a court case next week with the BBC. Hi, Matt, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony.
First of all, can you just tell us a bit about yourself?
I live in Sussex, and my brother used to work for Reuters in New York, and I used to work for a kind of subsidiary of Reuters in the city in London. And, Jeff was over there. Actually, it wasn't his normal place of work. It was just a conference that he was attending, which, you know, one of my co-directors of my software company was going to attend, but didn't in the end. He had a client to see that week instead in New York. But I'm just an ordinary chap who's just trying to get some justice for my brother in other legal action. But I'm rambling, sorry. But
Tell us a bit about your brother's job. What was he doing for Reuters?
Yeah, he was a risk management consultant. He'd been kind of doing that as a freelance for a few years prior to 1999. And he got a job with Reuters, moved out to Manhattan, and he'd been there obviously a couple of years. And he met his fiance there as well, who's a girl from Boston.
It's a tragic story, but how did you get going back to 2001, if you don't mind, how did you find out? It must have been awful.
I was actually on holiday with my wife and two children at the time, and my mum had just flown out. We'd had a week in Lanzarote, and she flew out on the, I think it was the Monday before. She'd spoken to Jeff on the Sunday, obviously looking forward to the holiday. And I think my wife sort of went up to go and get the kids some sort of late lunch or a snack off the beach, and sort of said, oh, you know, something's happened in New York, and I went up there. I'm pretty sure at the time the second tower had fallen. That was the tower. My brother was in the North Tower. And then it was just, you know, I mean, I had a mobile, but it was at the hotel, so it was just, you know, scrabbling around trying to get hold of people in England, and sort of finally found out probably about an hour later. So I don't know, probably talking in US time around 10 o'clock. Found out that, you know, he had gone to the conference, but we didn't really accept it until probably a few days later, because obviously we were hopeful that maybe he was injured or one of the hospitals, etc.
Well, that must have been an awful time for you, but how long did it take you to start questioning what had happened, and, you know, particularly the media coverage of that day?
I do actually remember it was an article that John Pilger had written, and I think it was end of October in 2001, and he actually said something like, this war is a farce. And I remember then reading a few things from Noam Chomsky wrote, and I think by sort of mid 2002 I was of the opinion that the US government had let it happen on purpose, wasn't aware of the LIHOP acronym, and I think pretty much by 2004 I was right down the rabbit hole and thought that they were knee deep in you know, the events of September 11th.
Well, tell us a little bit about this.
Not the official story, let's put it that way.
Tell us a bit about this LIHOP, MIHOP, the acronym. What does it mean?
Well, I guess it must have several interpretations. I mean, the LIHOP is just let it happen on purpose, which I guess the closest people have referred to that is Pearl Harbor. But the make it happen on purpose is obviously them being involved at some level, the architecting, the planning, the engineering, and actually carrying out the attacks. But I mean, that's obviously not why I'm in court on Monday with the BBC.
Yes, tell us about that. What made you first decide to take the BBC on? Because this is quite a big organisation, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, effectively they're taking me on because it's something as you know, trivial, I guess, as not paying my TV licence. And I made a conscious decision after I'd heard of a chap called Tony Rook take the same action, that he didn't want to break the law by funding the BBC through the TV licence, basically because of the way that they have been not only covering up the real events of 9/11, but in particular, you know, manipulating footage to deliberately, you know, for example, I think in the conspiracy files on Building 7, they actually omit the sounds of explosion from the actual original footage. And, you know, you've got to ask yourself, why are they doing this and for what purpose? And to not, it's particularly, I think, before the National Institute of Standards and Technologies had actually admitted that Building 7, that's the third tower that fell at freefall, You know, the BBC and NIST were both saying, you know, it's impossible, and gave lots of, you know, sensible reasons why you couldn't have free fall in an organic fire caused collapse. And then, of course, after pressure, I think, from a physics teacher called David Chandler at one of the NIST meetings, NIST did eventually turn around and go, actually, yes, we admit it fell for free fall for 2.25 seconds. So, I mean, once that came out, I mean, a lot of people, you know, I've got at least 500 people contacting the BBC saying, you've got to report this, because this is, it's important. You know, it has a lot of scientific implications to actually have the free fall. You know, that the only way we know that it can be done for sure is through controlled demolition. And for the BBC to not report that, you know, they're supposed to, they've obviously got obligations under the Royal Charter, etc., but then to also put out the so-called conspiracy files documentaries in such a very biased and, you know, manipulated way, for me, taking the same conclusion that Tony Rook had, you know, they are effectively supporting the real terrorists behind 9/11 who killed my brother. And in funding or paying for the TV license, I would fall foul of the Terrorism Act legislation, which is Section 15, Article 3, which is essentially, it's an offence to if you have reasonable cause to suspect that you would be funding the purposes of terrorism. There are some other sections that will form part of my defence, 38B and Section 17 as well, but I mean the main crux of it is the Section 15, Article 3. So that's what the case, that's the argument we're trying to put forward. However, we have a first hurdle to get through, which is the issue of strict liability. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but that's where essentially if you've been caught or you've admitted to committing an alleged offence, then there is no defence. It's just, you know, you're found guilty and that's it. Obviously, in this particular case, it's a conflict of law, and I would argue that I'm potentially guilty of not having an appropriate license. I'm happy to pay, I say happy in inverted commas, the BBC, I'm happy to pay for a TV license, provided that no money goes to the BBC, you know, which is the only circumstance that I would be prepared to pay a TV license. Well, now, whether I'll actually be able to be able to present my defence using the Terrorism Act laws, I don't know. Because if I don't get past the strict liability issue, which it seems ridiculous that you can't actually defend yourself in court. I mean, that is actually a violation of your human rights, Article 6, which is a right to a fair trial and call witnesses, etc. So I really don't know until I'm in the courtroom how it's going to turn out on Monday.
So I mean, from a sort of layman's point of view, obviously, you know, you're not an expert in, I would imagine, in architecture or anything like that. But you mentioned a couple of things. One of the things that strikes me is the very surprising comments by a certain Jane Stanley on 9/11 itself, who was on BBC World, when she announced the collapse of Building 7, the third building that came down. This is the World Trade Center, the Salomon Brothers building, I think it's called. Whilst it was still, she said another building has collapsed called the Salomon Brothers building, and yet there it was still in the picture behind her.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the arguments, which is the Section 38B. I mean, they had an obligation. They obviously had foreknowledge. I mean, they, you know, effectively a terrorist event, the collapse and destruction of Building 7. But they had an obligation to inform the authorities, and certainly once they realised their mistake, and obviously the building eventually did collapse, they certainly, as a journalist and broadcaster, had obligations that they didn't follow up. I understand that the first time they actually looked into it was about 2006, which is hardly what you would expect. You know, a journalistic organisation like the BBC to do. So late. I mean, it should have been immediately looked at. I mean, they have said that the report has come from Reuters, but, you know, no one's followed that up, including the police.
That's ironic that your brother was
working for... should have followed up. Sorry.
It's ironic that your brother was working for Reuters.
Yes, and I said me indirectly. I used to work for a company called Technicom, which then became TIBCO, which was bought by Reuters. But yeah, I mean, I have actually, you know, it's not something I should be doing either as a family member or as a concerned citizen, you know, trying to find out where that report came from. You know, so I've been making my own inquiries to they're now called Thomson Reuters, to find out where that report came from. If indeed, you know, Reuters did provide the BBC, we don't know that. That's just something that Richard Porter said in a documentary. But the main point is, you know, they had at least 23 or whatever it was, 22 minutes advance warning of or knowledge of the collapse of Building 7. Because obviously, you know, where did that report come from if it wasn't
amazing, isn't it? It almost sounds like a scripted event, 9/11,
yeah,
rather than,
yeah,
reporting a news event. I would point out that Axe Grinder in the Press Gazette, at the time of that documentary, this is an anonymous column in Press Gazette, which is for journalists, really had a pot shot at Richard Porter, his explanation as to why this happened, saying, "Pull the other one, lizard man." And I don't think most journalists, certainly freelancers whose job doesn't depend on what they say, would approve of that at all. But anyway, look, just to round up, we wish you the very best of luck next week, Matt. But just round up by telling us a little bit about Jeff as a person.
Yeah, I mean, he was very popular, gregarious. He was an intelligent chap. He had a couple of degrees, and you know, he was just very friendly and just warm to anyone that he'd meet. And you know, it's just so, I mean, it just tore a hole out of obviously our family, but a huge sort of network of friends. He'd only got engaged middle of August, you know, three, four weeks before it happened. He came over to England to visit with his new fiance, and, you know, went round to meet family and friends, and, you know, just that whole future and stuff has just been, you know, ripped away. And and my poor old mum and dad having to deal with that. I'm a parent. I don't know how you deal with, you know, the murder of your child. I, you know, couldn't even think about it.
Well, look, Matt Campbell, thanks very much for coming on and talking about it, and let's hope we get to the bottom of this sometime.
Yeah. Thanks, Tony. Cheers.
Thank you.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Pretty shocking stuff there, Martin. And you're part of the Reinvestigate 9/11 campaign, aren't you?
I am, as is Matt. The main point that he's making about the WTC7, I mean, many people listening to this show will be aware that three buildings collapsed on 9/11. WTC7, you just carry out a basic computer search and you will see the picture of this building crashing into its own footprint at free fall speed. And of course, the BBC reporting it being destroyed 20 minutes before it was, which suggests, as you said earlier, that it was a scripted event, which means the whole thing was a scripted event.
How many, I suppose the question has to be, how many of these other big terrorist spectacular events have been scripted for TV?
Well, I mean, going back, the historical record is pretty full of intelligence services.
Well, have you got any evidence that any others have been?
Well, Bologna bombing in 1980 was uncovered through police investigation in Italy and by parliamentary investigation in both Italy, Belgium and Switzerland. The finger was pointed very, very firmly at the NATO intelligence services being behind that attack, which killed over 80 innocent people in Bologna railway station. The fact is that terrorists are not always losers on the outside of a system. They can also be big players at the centre of a system, trying to manipulate public opinion and to scare people. We are being terrorised, and there are terrorists, but many of them are in fact paid by our own government.
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
And I'm joined in the studio now by Mohammed Mukawi, who has the show after us. Hi, Mohammed. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony. Hi.
Yes. Well, we normally hear you afterwards, but we have you on today because of the Mohammed Emwazi case particularly, and the fact that there were various attempts to recruit him and many others to the security services, MI5. And I understand you had a similar type of an experience, which is fascinating. So can you just take us through it?
Yeah, it and that's long time ago, like 98, 99, and I was just a newcomer to Bristol.
From?
I came from London, and before that I was in the Sudan. So I was 2 years in London. I moved to Bristol to do work experience with British Aerospace, the Airbus.
Okay, just tell us a bit about your job, your profession.
I was an aircraft maintenance engineer, and that's why I moved to Bristol. And I came and 2 years. I was doing a part-time job with Pakistani's brothers, and they are involved in, at that time, Bosnia and Herzeg was going, and they're doing a charity work, and I was working in one of their petrol stations as a part-time after I do my work experience in the British Aerospace. By accident, I don't know, I've been witness in a criminal act or a crime. So the two CID, they came to take my statement.
Okay, so what did you see? What crime? What did you see?
I didn't see anything. Just by accident, my neighbor, the council offered me a flat here in around Easton. I took it, was in the flat for 2 months. A lady, she came and she asked me to provide her with the mail off, and she was my ex-neighbor by so coincidence. And she said, can you pass me the mail of the man who used to live here? And I said, I don't know the man who used to live here, and I'm not going to do that. Why you want it for? She said, my boyfriend, he is... tried to kill that man, which is the man who used to live in the flat where I am living now. So it's attempting murder, and it's about gangs, the drugs gangs and stuff like this. And I wasn't involved, but they took my statement and they went, and they moved me from my flat because to protect me as a witness, because they said after I signed the statement, they said you're gonna be a witness. Until here, we are fine. After they moved me from my new flat, there is one. I thought he's a CID, but he wasn't. He came every week, like chatting about the court and the case, and you know. But after 2-3 visits, I discover. Who is real? He's MI5 recruiter.
Did he actually tell you that? How did you discover?
He did. I mean, after because he came in a friendly way of telling me, what do you think working with us? I said, who with us? Who are you?
Right. So he was almost trying to get you to guess who he was working for.
Yeah, exactly. And because before that he asking me about my Muslim community. And about some personnel, I know very well, and I didn't know he know about them.
So, did he ever actually show you any credentials to prove what he said?
No, he didn't. But he said, "We know about these people, and we want you to pass us some information. And if you work with us, that will be good for you." At that time, I was applying for an asylum.
Ah, right. So the implication was...
political asylum, yeah, because I came from as a refugee. And so I said, so what I'm going to gain out of it? Because I want to try to play him and to take some information out of him. He said, we're going to guarantee you your status, and we're going to give you money by the side, and everything you ask is going to be fine. And even he gave me a nickname when I call the number.
A code name?
A code name, yeah.
What was the code name?
A playboy or something like this.
Okay. So did you take the money?
No, actually, I refused it straight away, and I gave him a lecture, and I kicked him out, actually. I said to him, listen, I came from a country because I am being oppressed over there, and I hate the security service. Because they used to spy on me. Do you expect me to spy on my own people or anyone in that matter? So I was firm with him. I said to him, I don't want to see your face until the court day. And that's what happened, actually. And he said, okay, but don't tell anybody. I said, that's not up to you to tell me. I supposed to be a witness in a criminal case, but now it's moved to be a spy case, and I'm not going to be your spy, and I'm not going to spy on my own community and my own people. And that's about 17 years ago we're talking.
Well, that's a fascinating story, Martin. It almost seems as if this whole area of ganglands and criminality was used to almost suck Mohammed into a situation where the security services, MI5, were actually trying to kind of compromise him into playing ball with them.
Yeah, well, the way they justify this is to say
it's
that
a kind of coercion,
isn't
it?
They need to infiltrate these organisations, and that's why they say that. But a lot of the people who end up taking the blame for these attacks are people who are vulnerable, who've been manipulated into a position where it looks as if they are the guilty parties. But of course, these people are not really very successful as terrorists.
Well, they must have looked at Mohammed and said, well, in a way, he's vulnerable because he wants to get his asylum.
Exactly, that's it. But unlike some of these other people, he's an educated person, he's got resources and so on, so you're able to bat it off. But if you have been in trouble with the law or mental health issues or drug problems, then of course those can be used against you. And, of course, the purpose of this is to actually set up, create fear in the community about Islam and Muslims, and also to achieve various geopolitical goals. The actual blowing things up isn't done by those people.
And they targeted community, actually. So many of them, they came to me after that. And many of them, I mean, some of them, they live with me. And when they come through, even from Edinburgh, Belfast, whichever, through the airport, they've been stopped and been asked this question. And the same person, the same MI5 person, he was in the airport once. I went to pick up my friend, and by accident, he was staying with me. And he said to him, I stay in number so-and-so with Mohammed Makawi. He said, Mohammed Makawi, I said. And when he was coming out, he was following him. And he said, don't look, because that guy, I said, who? And I recognized him straight away. And when he saw me, he turned back. So,
well, you've been in the middle of it, man.
Oh, yeah.
We don't realize that when we listen to your Arabian Nights show every Friday evening. Yeah. Martin, do you think this is pretty commonplace? It's interesting that a lot of this anti-Islamic stuff started after Operation Cyclo, didn't it? And Mohammed's talking there about the Kosovo War too.
Yeah, well, during the Kosovo War, in Bosnia in the 90s, these international Islamic brigades that have been sent to Afghanistan, to Bosnia, and now into Syria. Yeah. These are all orchestrated by Western intelligence services. Did you see what happened the other day? That girl, British girl, the Turkish police have arrested the person that was infiltrating her into Syria, and it turns out he's a spy. For the Canadian government.
Well, we haven't heard that on the news.
No, it's out there in the mainstream news in the rest of the world.
Yes, but not here.
But what's beginning to happen is that we're not hearing the full truth.
So, for example, the young Syrian, a young girl from Bristol that went over to Syria, the three girls that went over to Syria, almost certainly entrapped by the security.
Well, we don't know who entrapped them, but we know that these groups are working hand in glove.
Not
with Western
necessarily
services,
by our own people.
With the Saudis, the Turkish military, MIT, all of these people are recruiting. International jihadists to go into
anyway,
Syria.
Mohammed, yeah. I wonder if you've got any kind of tips for people that think that they might be being recruited by the security services from your experience.
Yeah, actually, I don't know who being recruited, because when they get recruited, you don't know about them because it's been a top secret, and they tell them not to do and not to talk to anyone. And I know our communities have been infiltrated, and but. I'm telling the rest of the community who's not been corrupted yet or been asked by the secret service, the MI5 or MI6, whichever, not to cooperate with them.
But don't you agree that they have to do something to at least to have some kind of infiltration of these groups?
Yeah, but who made them in the first place? I mean, MI5, MI6, the Western and CIA and all of them.
Yeah, I mean, the record is clear. These groups, particularly under Operation Cyclone in the 1980s, were set up by MI6 CIA. Yeah. No doubt about it. Osama bin Laden definitely worked for the CIA. So when they say, the story is they then lost control of these groups. I don't believe it.
No, me too.
Okay, well, thank you both very much for a bit of an insight into the man behind the Arabian Nights show, which comes on after this show. Thanks very much, Mohammed Makawi.
Thank you, Tom.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com and leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
Now we're joined by Steve Satan, who's also a presenter on here. Steve, first of all, just start off by telling us when your show is on.
Well, funnily enough, it's changed. I'll be on the radio tomorrow, but I'm normally on 1 till 3, but this week I'm doing 4 till 6. It's all changed around a little bit because of the women's football match that's happening at Ashton Gate. And also Monday I do 12 till 2, lunchtime.
But you're here to talk about Metrobus, because the last of the protesters have been torn out over last weekend, the beginning of this week, from Stapleton allotments. They were trying to save a piece of land, which is a beautiful bit of small holdings and allotments area, which has been kind of forgotten by the council. But it's cheap because it's council land. This is for the Metro bus. And what I really want to hear from you is this going to revolutionise transport in the city and actually make a big difference, like, for example, the trams in Manchester and elsewhere?
Absolutely not. This is an absolute white elephant of a scheme that, even by the council's own admission, will have a negligible impact on congestion in the city. The benefit is so marginal that it represents, for £100 million or whatever it's going to end up costing, it represents exceptionally poor value for money. And this point you're making about using green land because it's cheap, which is true, but it's also kind of lazy, isn't it? You can imagine some planner, you know, with a map. Oh, where can we run a new bus route? Oh, there's the green land. That's the easy option.
Well, it's council owned.
They can get compulsory purchase orders and so on, you know. So they don't have to sort of destroy commercial buildings or people's homes.
So tell us, what are they going to look like, these Metro bus? Is it a tram? Is it a bus?
No, they'll try and claim. I mean, if you look at all the propaganda, particularly all the early propaganda for this scheme, it says it'll be a tram-like experience, and they show pictures of these trams. Well, they're actually buses that look like trams, but no one's built them. They don't exist. They're just someone's fantasy. And they are just buses.
Tram-like fantasy.
Yeah, tram-like fantasy. A sham tram, someone described them. That's very rightly as well. You know, they're just buses. It's what's different? Should we go back to the beginning? This is one of these projects that's just sort of built up a momentum of its own. It's gone out of control. A while back, the government were interested in running public transport schemes on the cheap. Because if you look at the basic costs, buses are cheaper than trams or trains. So can we, you know, let's have a public transport scheme on the cheap. All we have to do is run these buses. They're so-called guided buses that run down these sort of between two huge concrete curbs, if you like, with wheels sticking out the side that guide them automatically.
So the driver can put his feet up as they're going along those narrow roads.
That's
especially
right,
designed for the bus.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now that's not the whole of the Metrobus. It's only relatively short sections are guided. But the government was keen to sort of promote these guided buses as a cheap alternative to trains or trams. Let's see if we can do it. Here's some money. So some idiot in Bristol City Council chased this funding, saying, "Oh, you know, we can come up with a scheme to attract this funding if we can run the bus. Oh, I don't know, down here along the old Harbour Railway and put a few guided sections in." It's just a monstrous turkey of a scheme.
So most big cities have got themselves a tram by now. Have we been fobbed off with this?
Well, yeah, we have been conned. Yeah, I mean, it's going to cost all of us big time, and it will deliver no benefits. Now, interestingly, you know, why has...
No, hang on. You can't say that. It's obviously going to deliver some benefits from, you know, some people that use it, commuting.
Negligible benefits. And bear in mind, these aren't new routes. These are existing bus routes, which are just diverted on this new route, some of which go where people don't want to go. The current routes that go along the Hot Wells Road and into the city centre are going to be less convenient on the... on the new metro bus route down Cumberland Road or wherever it goes. But it's interesting to compare the European experience. As we know, you know, Europe is way ahead of us on public transport in pretty much every respect. And they've tried guided buses, and they found them wanting. There's a French guided bus scheme. I can't remember where it is. One of the major cities in France is abandoning its guided buses and converting them all to trams. And we'll learn the hard way that that's what we'll have to do in 10 or 20 years' time when it's shown that this stinking turkey of a metro bus has been proven to be a waste of time and money.
Now,
it hasn't delivered the public benefits that people expect, and we'll do it properly.
Now, you're from this organisation, Rail Futures, so obviously you're going to support a tram because a tram runs on rails.
No, not necessarily. I mean, there is a separate campaign group, the Light Rail Association, who are big on trams. But the point is, buses have a huge role to play. Buses are not a bad thing. I'm not anti-bus, but I'm anti a scheme that simply won't work and that will be a monstrous waste of money when that money could be so much better spent on, obviously, yes, I would prefer rail schemes like Portishead, and which is probably going to happen anyway, and the Henbury Loop Line and all these other packages that will bring benefits to the public. I mean, the Severn Beach Line is a classic example of where you invest the money, you put on a better service, and the passenger numbers keep going up and up and up. And I think, you know, the reality that politicians try and deny is if you want decent public transport, it has to run on rails.
Nancy in France is where this
that's where I'm thinking of, yeah.
There's
yeah.
a great article I've just dug up. A misguided bus, it says. Nancy's BRT debacle exposes the pitfall of half-price trams. Does the guided bus really have any purpose in life?
No. And there are two other examples in Britain. There's the Cambridge busway, which is a huge failure, where they converted a very long length of railway, and they proudly boasted that it was the longest guided bus in the world or something. And, you know, it hasn't delivered the numbers that they'll claim that it has. But you go to the outskirts of Cambridge and watching these people go through the countryside on this former rail route with almost no passengers on these guided buses.
So when's it due to be actually usable?
I think we're probably looking at about 2 years. I don't know, and frankly, I don't care. You know, I mean, because it's just a waste of money. And there's another really, really important point I'd like to make as well, actually. Of course, we are the green capital of Europe, supposedly. And here is this, you know, stinking waste of money tearing up greenbelt land for something that just won't deliver. It's the European city of hypocrisy. And George Ferguson, you know, he promised he'd scrap it. He didn't. He's a hypocrite, and he should be ashamed of himself.
So what would you like to see in its place, and where should some sort of a tram system, I imagine, where should it actually run? And does this metro bus run anywhere near the right sort of routes to actually draw in lots and lots of people?
Well, no, it doesn't.
And to relieve the car congestion?
Absolutely not. It isn't integrated with existing bus routes. It's been sort of arbitrarily drawn up on the basis of where can it run rather than where should it run. I mean, there are any number of public transport schemes. I've mentioned some already, you know, and I'd welcome more investment in bus routes if they were well planned out and they were going to deliver benefits, unlike this metro bus, which, like I say, is chasing funding. It's going to cost us all dear, and it's a complete monstrous turkey and a waste of money.
Is it? Why haven't we got a tram? Why is it? Because we've been trying for years. Surely this is better than nothing.
I think that's debatable. I think it isn't better than nothing, actually. I think it would be better to scrap the whole thing. I mean, trams are expensive. They need long-term commitment from, you know, probably across the political spectrum, and they are more expensive to set up. But the point is, when you make that investment, you reap the benefits in the long term. You know, these schemes in Manchester and Croydon, they're building one in Birmingham, they've been hugely successful. Nottingham is probably the best example, actually. And in Nottingham, they're expanding their tram scheme because it has been so successful and well planned out and built with public support. I don't see much public support for the metro bus.
Okay, just remind us again when you're on the radio here playing your, spinning your tunes.
4 till 6 tomorrow, normally 1 till 3, and Monday lunchtime 12 till 2.
Okay, Steve Satan, thanks very much for joining us.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Now we're joined by Simon Lewis from, I'm not sure quite what you are from. I know you're certainly from Montpellier and that sort of area, and you've been involved in the Carriage Works. Is it the Carriage Works Action Group by any chance,
yes,
Simon?
Yes, I'm a member of the Carriage Works Action Group liaison team, so I'm here this evening to speak about where we're at with our...
Yeah, well, we mentioned it briefly earlier on, the Carriage Works. How's it all going?
It's going interesting at the moment, very interesting. We've got an application in by Fifth Capital, And it's not great, and we need lots and lots of people to check out our guide on the website and have a look at the scheme and see what it is you don't like and comment.
Well, what if you do like it?
Then also comment.
Okay, so what are they planning, Fifth Capital, and is it actually really going to happen?
It's a very, very tricky site. There's an awful lot of things to try and squeeze on the site to get the yield right, and I think they're trying to...
What's that, the number of homes?
Yeah, to make the site pay. So it's a difficult site to develop, and so they're cramming an awful lot in, and it's not a particularly good site. There's a very, very big shortage of social housing, which is what's actually needed in the area.
Okay, and are Fifth Capital planning some of that?
They're planning 7 units out of 118, I think it is.
Okay, so surely, I mean, this is a bit of a no-brainer, surely, Simon, is that people have been waiting for something to happen there for decades. Finally, something's happening, and yet you're still objecting.
There could be, it could be we
it's
end
a bit
up
like what
a...
we just heard with Steve and the Metro bus, you know, exactly. It's like a bit of curmudgeonliness here.
Well, do we really want to see a development of properties that are bought up by overseas investors and left empty while the rest of us end up struggling to find somewhere to live in the neighbourhood?
So you think they will be?
Could be.
What sort of objections have you made, and have the Carriage Works Action Group's action group itself been making?
Well, we've been looking at how the site has got not enough social housing. It's overcrowding a lot of the properties around it, so it's very, very high, the lack of light, the size of the units, the mix of the units, the lack of amenity to local people. So there's not really enough mix of business uses and stuff like that. So if you look at our community vision, which was an award-winning consultation, it's really paid lip service to it. So I think we could get a much, much better what I'd like Fifth Capital to do is to, in light of the 1,000 oppositions that have now been posted, maybe they'd like to withdraw their planning application and talk to us in more detail about getting it right.
So what was the point of this consultation if they've now just ignored it?
Well, the Fifth Capital have an option with the owners of the site. They'd like to develop it. That's entirely up to them. The reason we did the whole consultation was to try and push forward the opportunity for a developer, and we went through a process of selecting a preferred developer to enter into a compulsory purchase.
But I come back to this whole thing of surely it's better something happens there. I mean, we were living in what we were often told are difficult times for developers. I mean, the actually making a site pay, you've said yourself, is very difficult these days. Sometimes they're saying, well, look, simply we either can't raise the money to build it, or if we do, we've got to make sure that there's going to be enough income to repay whatever it is loan we managed to get to build it in the first place. So if times are tight, I mean, we heard earlier on, we were just discussing briefly the situation down at Bristol General Hospital, where there's a big old public building that's been sold for housing, where there was a large contingent of social housing built in there. The developers down there too are now saying, well, the social housing is going to have to go out the window, otherwise this project simply isn't viable.
Yes, of course. One of the things that was in the community vision, one of the key things that came out of the consultation, was that we do want to see the site get developed. It has been derelict now for a very, very long time. It's been like 35 years, depending on when you start counting. So, of course, we want to see the site developed. Now, with the yield, have the numbers add up on the site, any developer would like to maximise their profits. So, you know, perhaps they'd like to turn it into a casino. I don't know. I mean, it's for the local authority to actually, you know, say, well, hang on a minute. The local plan, the local planning document, the SPD 10, the community vision, outlines what the need in the area is. And if they've negotiated to build something that's going to end up making the yield work, but they're paying too much for the site, then that's where the numbers don't stack up. So we want to make sure that if we do something, let's do it properly, because there's still plenty of time to change and tweak that current application to make it work.
Now, I've heard a couple of things. I suppose both of them rumours, really. That's what your thoughts are. One of them is that Fifth Capital don't actually really have the money and intend to seriously develop it, that this is just a blocking move to stop the council's compulsory purchase order to do something which does include much more social housing. Let's hear your thoughts on that.
We put together the whole consultation, the community vision, and went through the European procurement rules in order to select a preferred developer to go forward with a compulsory purchase on the site. Now, as soon as Fifth Capital entered into an agreement with the owners and said that they had an option to buy the site, then all of a sudden our preferred developer that is understandably is risk averse. And although there is apparently been a large lump of money set aside to underwrite that process, that money's not been spent. That process has halted while Fifth Capital have put together their proposal. Ideally, I would like to have seen two proposals go in and then we could have, you know, measured them side by side.
But the other rumour is to do with the owners of the site and saying that they're apparently that in order to serve a compulsory purchase order, they've actually got to be on British soil, and they're not on British soil, and they would have to, you have to wait until they actually caught a plane and flew to Heathrow or Bristol Airport and then serve the compulsory purchase order on them then. Do you know anything about that?
There are all sorts of rumours flying around about how compulsory purchase orders work. To be honest, we don't even need to be halted by this planning application. We could actually move forward with the compulsory purchase order because the gutters need fixing. Now, maybe we should just get on with doing that.
Sounds like a good idea. Simon, what's the best way for people to follow what's going on there to do with the Carriage Works and Westmoreland House?
If you have a look at our website, carriageworks.org.uk, you will see the latest articles, and there's a step-by-step guide of how to get your application, if you're in favour of a scheme or you're opposed to it, then do go to the, follow our link to the council website, do fill in have your say. But make sure that you fit within the planning guidelines and the rules. You can't just say, I don't like the colour, or, you know, I don't like them. What we need to do is actually pick on particular key issues. So I'm particularly concerned about the heritage of the Carriageworks site itself and how that's developed. I'm also very, very interested in the fact that it was previously a commercial building, and so it brought a large amount of employment to the area. So just housing is not enough. I think the mix isn't right. So those are a few key things that I'm personally very enthusiastic for. So make sure if you do put in an objection, make sure that you're actually following the guidelines that we've put on the carriageworks.org.uk website, so that what is especially important to you fits within the planning criteria. But we've got practically 1,000 objections now, so I think it's about time Fifth Capital just came and talked to us about how they could make it better.
Also, there's another organisation, or I don't know how organised it is, but it's a website. Anyway, it's called thebristolparty.com/carriageworks. It's a part of that. And they're saying that there are action meetings every Monday at 6:30 at the People's Republic for Stokes Croft, a little bit further down Stokes Croft. And the one thing I'd say about that, Simon, is that there's a beautiful picture on their website of the Carriage Works. It looks like, I'm guessing, this is about 1959, 1960, from the opposite side of the road. And it just gives you an idea of what the place could look like if it's actually being used. There's people going in and out, it looks like, of the Carriage Works there. And there's a building next door. It looks actually like it's got a bit of whitewash on the back, so that shop might have been closed. But certainly it seems to be reasonably thriving with people walking up and down. So that's the way I guess we want to see it again in the future.
We have a very, very bright, vibrant and diverse neighbourhood. So lots of different people have got lots of different approaches. What I would remind people who have got all of these wonderful ideas about how they might like to tackle this issue, don't forget to follow the proper channels as well. Do make sure you get your planning objection in. So if you're planning on having a picket or a demonstration, you know, all of these things may well be great for getting press attention, but make sure you're actually following the proper route through the planning portal with the carriageworks.org liaison group, please.
As well. It looks like there's a lots of strata to Stokes Croft that may be surfacing in the next few months, depending on how this planning application goes. We shall see. But anyway, just to remind you, there are meetings every Monday at People's Republic for Stokes Croft. That's on the just onto Jamaica Street off of Stokes Croft at 6:30 every Monday. And Simon Lewis from Carriage Works Action Group, thanks ever so much for joining us again here on The Politics Show.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com and leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
And so, Martin, we're going to talk now a little bit about the band Vicar from Virginia Water. That's Reverend Stephen Sizer. Tell us a little bit about what you think the results are of actually banning him, because he's been told in church, in his sermons, he's not allowed to talk about the Middle East, which seems a bit bizarre.
Well, he's obviously always been very active around the Israel-Palestine issue, but the reason why he's been banned is because he put a link on his Facebook page or something of similar to an article about Israeli involvement in the 9/11 attacks.
Well, that article's called 9/11, Israel Did It, All the Proof in the World.
Well, I've read the article, and in actual fact, it's obviously a biased article, but nevertheless, there's plenty of factual information in there about Israeli intelligence services' involvement in the 9/11 attacks. And I'm afraid if people are going to insist on freedom of speech, including, you know, disreputable cartoons of other people's religious believers, then I'm definitely going to insist that we're allowed to accuse intelligence services of engaging in terrorism, because they do.
OK, well, now let's have a listen to Stephen Sizer, who talks a bit about the six pillars of Zionism. This is before he was banned a couple of years ago. Is the idea that Zionism is not just a sort of belief that the Bible says that the Israelis can have the land and the Zionists can have the land in the Holy Land. It's actually a whole political program, and there's six particular stages to it.
In 2006, at the inaugural event for Christians United for Israel, after recorded greetings from George W. Bush in the presence of four U.S. senators, as well as the Israeli ambassador to the United States, John Hagee said this. He said, quote, "The United States must join Israel in a preemptive military strike against Iran to fulfill God's plan for both Israel and the West, a biblically prophesied end-time confrontation with Iran, which will lead to the rapture, tribulation, and second coming of Christ." So it's all right then. The danger of this theology is not that it is so fatalistic, but that it seems so contagious. Clearly, Christian Zionism as a movement has profound and lasting political consequences. Christian Zionists, and there are some here I've met already, show varying degrees of enthusiasm for implementing those six convictions. First, the belief the Jews remain God's chosen people leads Christian Zionists to justify Israel's military occupation of Palestine. Two, as God's chosen people, the final restoration of the Jews to Israel is therefore encouraged and facilitated by bringing the Jews back to the land. Third, the land as delineated scripture belongs exclusively to Jewish people, and therefore they justify the settlements and the occupation of the West Bank. Fourth, Jerusalem is the eternal exclusive capital of the Jews, and therefore it cannot be shared with the Palestinians, and they want to move the embassies back to Jerusalem. Fifth, the third Jewish temple must be built, the priesthoods consecrated and sacrifices reinstituted, and therefore some Christian Zionists support Jewish terrorist organizations committed to achieving that by force. And lastly, since Christian Zionists are convinced there will be an apocalyptic war in the near future, there is no prospect for peace between Jews and Arabs. Indeed, to advocate Israel compromises with Islam or coexist with Palestinians is to identify with those destined for judgment, and they're opposing God and Israel in the final battle of Armageddon. The consequences, therefore, for this uncritical support for the State of Israel is inherently and pathologically destructive, both for the future of Israel and the security of the West. But let me give you just a couple of passages to hopefully help you to see a corrective to the theology that I've introduced you to today. In the New Testament, the followers of Jesus Christ are called to be peacemakers, not widow makers. The path of nonviolence is the path Jesus has called us to. It is peacemaking that Jesus insists identifies the authenticity of those who claim to be his followers. "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God." Matthew 5, verse 9.
Martin, that's the Reverend Stephen Sizer talking in a way he's not allowed to talk about in his sermons in his church down at Virginia Water in Surrey. But the most shocking, I think, thing around it about Zionism is the fact that actually most Zionists are not Jewish at all.
Well, I mean, that's the fact is that Zionism is a political movement, and Israel is a state.
Well, Zionists would argue, actually, it's a religious movement based the Bible.
No, no. I mean, many Zionists are actually originally quite secularist. Zionism is itself a very varied movement. But fundamentally, I mean, it's been there was a BBC documentary that came out recently with some controversy that pointed out that many modern Jews are actually descended from Khazars, that is to say, a Turkic tribe who were based in what is now Crimea and converted to Judaism early in the 9th century. Now, in actual fact, there's nothing in Judaism that doesn't allow people to convert to it, although they don't actually try to convert people. But all we're talking about here is people having their various political and religious ideas. People generally do. The question is, are they being reasonable in their demands of others? And, of course, there is a big question mark over the State of Israel, which was basically given to the Zionist movement in defiance of the wishes of the population that already lived there.
But was it? Because actually it was taken by force, by terrorist force, by the Irgun, another terror gang.
Indeed, and the violent force that was used by the Zionist movement, also against British armed forces, by the way, was justified by the creation of the state, or was legitimated by the creation of the state. I mean, peacemaking involves recognising everybody's got different views, and therefore we're going to have to find some way of reconciling everybody's different views. The Israeli state, as in defiance of hundreds of UN resolutions, and receives no punishment whatsoever from the Western powers, and it's seen in the Middle East as a provocational warmonger. And of course, at the moment, one of the things that the Israeli state is doing is providing an air force for Al-Qaeda in Libya and Syria.
In what way?
Well, the Israeli Air Force is basically flying combat missions over Syria, which are designed to limit the effectiveness of the Syrian Arab Army as they attempt to try and deal with their insurgency. And there's a suggestion that Netanyahu, having won this election, will now pally up with the Saudis and use their bases for an attack on Iran, because both the Saudis and the Israelis are against the Iranians. So we could all be dragged down to war by the theocracy in Saudi Arabia and the jackbooted people who seem to be running Israel at the moment.
So to what extent is what Netanyahu and the Israeli state a racial entity or a religious entity?
Well, it's a bit of both, isn't it, really? The point is that it is a political thing. When we attack the Israeli state and the Israeli state's policies, and even go so far as to accuse them in being involved in 9/11, that is not an attack on Judaism or Jews. It's a political point that's being made. The politics are all wrong. You're being bullies, you're being terrorists, and that's nothing to do with your religion. It's being bullying and being a terrorist.
We have heard, though, after his election victory this week, Netanyahu's backing off from his pre-election stance, ruling out a Palestinian state.
Well, I mean, we'll see what happens. I don't think it's good news for the Middle East that he's won, but I understand that the position on the Palestinian side is they'd rather have Netanyahu in charge, because he basically makes it very difficult for people to support Israel, because he's so
militant. Exit polls said he was going to be kicked out, but he wasn't.
Yes, well, there's a question about that, isn't there? The exit polls said that he hadn't won, so it might be that the ballot boxes have been stuffed. It's happened before.
And one final bit of news this week from Osborne?
Well, the major thing that's happened this week is that Britain has decided to join the Asian Development Bank set up by the Chinese in defiance of the Americans, and various other European countries have also agreed, which is the geopolitical tectonic.
Fascinating. We'll have links to that on our show page, which is thisweek.org.uk. So time to sign off now. Mohammed will be up with the Arabian Nights after this. You can follow me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. We'll be back next week at 5 on Friday, and in the meantime, don't let those banksters get you down.
From the Sky News Centre.